Smith Show. So just a quick reminder, today is Giving Tuesday, as you all know, and I encourage everyone to consider a donation to Goats for the Old Goat, our good friend Ellen Ratner, who has been on the show many times over the years. She runs an NGO out of South Sudan, and the gift of a goat, it provides up to a liter of milk a day on small business opportunities for thousands of people in Sudan. My daughter still has the picture of where, you know, she donated money to get a goat, and they sent her a picture of the goat with her name, and someone, it was really nice. It's a good thing to do. So if you want more information, you can check out goatsfortheoldgoat.com. That's goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Let's find out what's going on around the world. We've got Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Very welcome.
So, evidently, World War III is going to begin there in Russia, Ukraine, Crimea. It won't be long now, right?
I mean, if you're Ukraine, you just have to be hoping that whatever happened this weekend near Crimea was just a misunderstanding or some sort of isolated Russian aggression. Because if you're looking for cues from the U.S. or from the European Union or NATO that they're going to really crack down on Russia because of this and dissuade them from further aggression, you're not seeing any of the right response.
Right. No, I mean, this is ridiculous. And I was looking at it, I'm going, is this the beginning of the getting the old band back together?
I mean, it's possible that this is just an isolated incident, but that is to, I think, discredit the sort of way that the Russian military and Russian strategists often are thinking multiple steps ahead on things, and they often like to sort of have dual intentions on a lot of these military acts, where it's not just about sort of achieving something immediately, but also testing out the response of the sort of your adversaries. And I think, you know, Russia sort of ticked off both boxes here. They kind of showed their ability to close off this inland sea, if you want to call it that, sort of a clumsy term, but basically a sort of a small sea that Ukraine really relies on to service a bunch of its ports along its southeastern coast. I mean, if Russia can block Ukrainian boats from accessing that entire area through this narrow little strait, the Kerch Strait, then, you know, Ukraine's going to have a lot of difficulty exporting goods from that part of the country, which will dive it into further economic despair. You're not going to be able to resupply those towns quite as easily, which is often, you know, a way of making an area more vulnerable when you make people, you know, make people worse off. They will blame probably the Ukrainian government, at least to a degree, and that's a ripe area for Russian misinformation to come in and flood the zone. And further, if Russia does really want to do some sort of military assault along this Ukrainian coastline and link up with what it's already conquered in Crimea, then you close off the ability for Russia to bring in Navy ships or for NATO to bring in, you know, naval ships through that area, that's a huge tactical advantage as well. So there are, I think, immediate objectives that are achieved in showing a show of force here and in demonstrating, I think, quite visibly the last, you know, 24 hours or so, that the U.S. is not at all interested, at least the administration is not. Maybe the Congress feels a little bit differently, and we'll see that play out. But the administration is not eager to tighten the screws and look for more sanctions, let alone coordinate some sort of transatlantic response here. That's got to be giving the Russians something of a green light here. And it shows you how much of a sort of twisted environment we're in, that when Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, soon to be former UN ambassador, I will add, and for a long time the most quote-unquote vocal critic of Russia, you know, says basically, hey, we're going to maintain sanctions and Russia's going to suffer reputational damage because of this, that's considered to be like a tough response for Russia. Yeah. I mean, compared to what Putin, from what Trump said, yes, it is. But that in and of itself is extremely weak.
Did Trump say anything? I mean, did I miss it? Go ahead.
I don't have the full quote, but Justin Duckham, our White House reporter, was out near Marine One the other day, or Monday afternoon, picked up some audio. He says basically, you know, we're not happy. And we've made it clear we're not happy about this. It's bad. And that was it. But he didn't name Putin. He didn't say he was going to get on the phone with Merkel and Macron and lead some sort of charge to do this. He didn't invoke NATO. He didn't talk about the importance of Ukraine as an ally. I mean, that's not the right response here. So, I mean, we'll see. I hope this is not the beginning of a new military aggression by Russia. It makes me sort of sick to think that we are living in an environment where a country could basically so clearly signal that it has territorial ambitions to peel off territory from another country. We're not guessing where that might be. We know what those next targets might be. And this country has done it before in very recent memory. And yet we're staring at it and finding reasons not to react. And I know the options are not very palatable either. I mean, you kind of are limited here in maybe what you can do. And unfortunately, the kind of sanctions we've wielded in the past, clearly, even if they've had economic impact in the short run, have basically failed to achieve any real political ends. So that does limit what we can do. But I don't know. It is depressing that we've seen the most depressing thing is not even just a lack of options, but the resignation to the fact that there are a lack of options. And that sort of means that we shouldn't do anything to begin with. I don't know how this is going to end, but the Ukrainian story, which has been off the headlines for a while, is certainly poised to possibly come back, and in a big way that could really hurt Ukraine.
Yeah, I've been looking at this. Not a lot of friends here. You know, if you're Ukraine, don't look to the West, because it doesn't look like we're going to do anything until it's too late. And this is the sad part of this. I mean, anybody who's ever played the game Risk knows how this plays out, and it's not good.
It's funny because you have, like, you could see an environment where the Trump administration has picked particular allies in Europe that we listen to more than others. Poland is an example of one of them. And the Poles are talking about this incident as being a kind of canary in the coal mine, right? Like, it may not in and of itself necessarily trigger a massive Russian escalation, but we would be fooling ourselves if we didn't see how it could very easily be the beginning of something bigger.
Nope.
And they say this in and of itself is enough for us to tighten the screws, go for a new round of sanctions, and we have to take it seriously. Well, that is not a message that's getting communicated to Washington, even if it's what the Poles are screaming at us on the phone. It's curious. We love to embrace the conservative Polish government when they're, you know, eroding the rule of law and doing all sorts of other things that really gel with the, you know, sort of agenda of the Trump administration. But we don't listen to them when they're talking about, you know, Russian aggression. Sort of very selective listening. But Estonia is screaming for help. You'd think that would be an ally we'd take very seriously because Russia's breathing down their neck and has really screwed them up a lot in the past few years, and it's been quite threatening. Poland is doing the same thing. And we're, you know, and in another administration, you could see us, even though there's just two countries, and Russia or in Germany and France and the Brits have been pretty quiet on this. It would not be inconceivable to say that in and of itself, that those are enough warning signs from enough important allies, NATO allies, no less, that we need to then amplify their voices and elevate this alarm. But we're not doing that.
Yeah, and this is one of those moments where you might look back in 3 or 4 years and go, really bad, no choice.
I think that's why Nikki Haley is at least, again, it's like I'm going to stop short of complimenting her for this because I still think she's not being vocal enough. But I do think it's telling that someone who we believe probably wants to run for president in several years, in a post-Trump era perhaps, thinks it's still important enough to go on the record, maybe for history's sake, and say, look, I was talking about this when others weren't. Because I do think it's absurd that we're in an environment now where, you know, mentioning a story about Russian aggression could be seen by Trump supporters as, you know, you're like rooting for Mueller. It's like it has nothing to do with that. And I think, you know, Haley knows that, or hopes that history will swing back and these clear violations of American ideals that are, you know, represented by Russia's actions will not be a partisan issue forever. I hope she's right.
Wow, you know, how screwed up are we as a country when that is now part of the calculus? You just want Mueller to win. You hate America.
It's amazing. Again, it's one of those things where if you could possibly take Trump out of it, I'm not going to disparage Republicans or conservatives by saying that they don't care about Ukraine. I mean, I'm sure they do. It's just they're so caught up into the way Trump frames these words and writes his own, you know, dictionary definitions that I don't think this is getting enough focus.
Let's move on to another foreign policy success by the U.S. Evidently, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is on a goodwill tour, doing the kissing babies tour, huh? What's going on?
Well, he made a stop in Egypt where he didn't face much criticism, which is what happens when a military government comes into power and criminalizes dissent and rips apart the free press. But he did also go to Tunisia, where he was met with big protests. I was glad to see that sort of success story, if you want to call it that, of the Arab Spring, seeing mass protests there. Found it kind of funny. It's a great visual. I wouldn't be comfortable seeing it in the ranks of a crowd around me, but people have been bringing chainsaws, evidently, to protest of Mohammed bin Salman in Tunisia, representing the bone saw that his execution squad sent to kill Jamal Khashoggi, brought along to the embassy in Istanbul. So that was an interesting, very visually stimulating protest that occurred for him today. And the tour of MBS, this coming out party after his getting a break from President Trump the other week, is going to take him later this week to Argentina for the G20 summit, where President Trump will evidently have a meeting with Vladimir Putin, though he, according to John Bolton, won't meet with the Saudi prince. But the Argentinian prosecutors are apparently looking into possible criminal charges against the Saudi crown prince for his conduct leading the disastrous war in Yemen and, to a lesser extent, any involvement he may have had in the Khashoggi affair. I think there's probably zero chance when you combine diplomatic immunity with just sort of the unlikely way that an arrest warrant could be handed down in a matter of days that anything is actually going to come of this. But it certainly puts MBS in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. And, of course, Argentina has a very checkered history when it comes to human rights. But it shows us that just how out of sync with the rest of the world's reaction the U.S. handling of this whole Saudi relationship has been. So many other countries, even if they're not going to take this extreme step of arresting foreign heads of state, realize that their people ought to find the kind of behavior embodied by the Saudis recently to be completely unacceptable. And they cause a public outcry. And it's really just the U.S. that doesn't, or a government at least, that doesn't even think it's worth sort of making the Saudis sweat at all for what they've done the past few weeks. So I'm a little bit glad when I see, you know, those protests in Tunisia and some you know, prosecutorial, you know, digging up of dirt in Argentina, even if nothing comes of it.
Yeah, at least you're talking about it. And look, and when Mr. Bonesaw comes to town, they break out the chainsaws. You know,
I will say, again, it's terrific as a former news photographer to see these photos of a crowd where people are holding up a chainsaw in the middle of thousands of people. I would absolutely not want to be at a protest with people holding chainsaws, yeah, even if I'm kind of agreeing with them. But from far away, I find it to be a quite effective form of protest.
I'm with you. But, you know, globally, I mean, and you look at what's going on our southern border right now with, you know, children being tear gassed. You know, the land of the free and the home of the brave and, you know, the place where we want the huddled masses to breathe free. It's not looking like our reputation around the globe is all that stellar right now.
I'm very curious to see how the G20 summit goes this weekend. The last time President Trump was hanging out with a bunch of other leaders was in Paris. He would prefer to be in his hotel room than standing arm in arm with them. And the last time they actually tried to sit down with other heads of state, which was in Quebec for the G7 summit over the summer, the U.S. was causing all sorts of problems, it seemed, agreeing on even a pretty milquetoast joint statement, you know, about like underlining some very, very basic rudimentary sort of democratic values. So this is a bigger cohort. There's a little, you know, higher, you know, quotient of nasty figures who will be at the G20 than there was up in Quebec. But I mean, it's going to be, there will be a lot of material to measure Trump's reputation on and America's standing. We'll be having talks with the Chinese on the future of this sort of trade spat. As much as they say Trump is not going to meet with the Saudis, I wouldn't put it past him to do something, a quick pull aside. And then there's, of course, a big direct meeting with Putin at a time when that, you know, the U.S.-Russia relationship, I think, is very closely watched. And then there's all the allies again. And it was funny that we're not even talking, like, we just have completely walled off any consideration of foreign policy victories with our allies. We only talk about trying to sort of hedge against horrible outcomes with our adversaries, but you'd think that another president would view the chance to hang out with, you know, a bunch of American friends to be an opportunity to pursue something positive. But that's just not at all what people think is, you know, Trump is capable of. And I agree with
that whole last paragraph, that whole last little bit there just makes me want to go back to bed and pull the covers over my head and just scream.
I was watching Netflix Chef's Table, which if you're a foodie is just absolute, it's just fantastic to watch. And I was watching one of the episodes on White Rabbit, which is a restaurant in Moscow, last night. And there's a brief interlude in this thing about, you know, high-end cuisine, in which they talk a little bit about the Russian invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. And they talk about the political consequences of it. And they don't show Obama until several seconds after he starts speaking. But his voice started playing over the segment, talking about how the U.S. finds all this action to be unacceptable. And I was it really just sort of lowered my blood pressure. And then Obama came on the screen, and it was that day where he showed up to the press briefing room in a tan suit. And I just was sitting there laughing. And that was a scandal under Obama, was that he, you know, we weren't taking the Ukraine crisis seriously enough, that he was disrespecting the Oval Office and you know, title of the president by wearing a tan suit, God forbid. And it put so many things into perspective, both how you typically talk about American values and project American values around the world, and then just sort of what passes as a scandal now versus what passed or what seemed to be a scandal back several years ago. Is pretty striking stuff.
Yeah, was that the same day where they had the Muslim prayer rugs as a backdrop? Do you remember that too? The drapes that had been there for like 50 years, the right was claiming they were Muslim prayer rugs.
I don't even remember that one, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was a scandal. That I guess you're telling me it was a scandal, but I'm not sure if it was on the same day.
Just crazy. Anyway, let's look at Zuckerberg. Evidently, was supposed to testify today in front of European lawmakers. No-showed. Why?
Yeah, this is pretty unprecedented. Not his no-show, because he's been turning down various requests or demands from investigatory panels all over the world of late, and sort of letting Sheryl Sandberg maybe and other sort of mid-level Facebook executives be the take the fall for that company's increasingly negative perception around the world. This was historic. There were 9 different countries represented at a joint hearing at the British Parliament. The first time one of those joint hearings has happened since 1933. I don't even know what the issue was at the core of that one, but shows you how seriously various lawmakers around the world are taking this sort of crackdown on the Facebook-led tech sector at this point. You had representatives from Canadian, British, Brazilian, Singaporean, French, Belgian, Irish, Latvian parliaments all there, a few others maybe, I guess, and they were wanted to grill Mark Zuckerberg, not just about, you know, the way that platform Facebook has been, you know, manipulated by foreign states, but also just the terrible way that company has treated the privacy of its users. And, you know, you don't need to look any further than the joint statement that these countries put out to suggest what might be in store for Facebook. These 9 different countries put out a paragraph in which they said, and I'll quote the key part, "It's incumbent on us to create systems of global internet governance," end quote. And even the British government put out a tweet, which I can't quote right now, but basically said 9 countries, dozens of lawmakers, you know, hundreds of millions of citizens expecting to get answers, and basically a no-show. And they showed a photo of an empty chair where Zuckerberg was supposed to be. I think in ducking accountability here, that Facebook is setting back its own company's goals and is probably going to bring regulation down upon, or I hope, on the social media industry as a whole. And there are a few routes that could go. You might see a call by more countries to implement the GDPR, those European Union, sort of internet privacy regulations that allow people to know what's being gathered about them and to have some of that information, if not all of it, deleted, and have pretty quick timelines that companies have to respond to those things and various requirements about how they store data. But I mean, one move I think is really interesting in a model, it's funny, you know, internet regulation is one of those things that, you know, people say, oh, maybe it's important or it's not important. But until you actually talk about the ways it could benefit consumers, people don't realize how great that regulation would be. think about mobile phones. You know, this is one piece of regulation that's often batted about is, you know, in the old days, if you wanted to switch mobile phone providers, the company would say, well, you can't, you have to get a new number. And that was seen as sort of a too high of a burden for many people. And so they wouldn't switch, even if they had a bad plan or were paying too much or the service was terrible, et cetera. And, you know, laws were passed in the U.S. that said, you know, companies have to let you move your phone number over, and right. they can't charge you for that. There's talk that, you know, these are your photos. These are your friends. These are your relationships. They're not Facebook's, even though Facebook may have claimed in the terms of service at one point that they were. These companies, if you, they not only have to delete your data if you want to quit the service, but if, like me, you want to leave Facebook but feel that they have too much of your information to make the jump, maybe Facebook has to give you your data in some sort of package that you could then bring over to X or Y new service that doesn't exist quite yet, but might in the future if the barriers to entry into creating a better social media platform were lowered a little bit. That's a great regulation. And I feel like if we talk about these things in concrete terms, the support for trying to rein in Facebook and its practices might be increased. So I was pretty actually heartened to see just how dragged through the mud Facebook was today at the British Parliament, and hopefully that pressure continues and maybe we see some improvements in this sector.
As it should. It should be dragged through the mud. I'm hoping for the same thing. I'm hoping, well, actually, I hate Facebook, so I don't use it. I stopped a long time ago.
Yeah. But I that idea of, and I know it doesn't exist now, because if you're a social media company, how do you convince someone to start anew? Now, I've been on Facebook at my little private high school in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was about, a stone's throw from Harvard, and we were one of the first high schools in the country to get Facebook because they rolled it out literally town by town through Massachusetts. And so I have been basically my entire life on Facebook, and the idea of leaving that all behind to start anew is overwhelming. But if I could pack it all up and migrate it over pretty quickly, and that's not a huge tech burden in the grand scheme of things these days, that could shake up the industry, and I think it would be a much-needed jolt.
There you go. Good stuff. Luke.